ARD.
That is my addiction. It's my art. I love to do what I do because the world is so confusing and antithetical to us and utterly without meaning of any kind. And so I like, through my art, to address these questions and try to find meaning for myself, and also to try to understand how I feel about what's happening in the world.
Orte und Worte, der Bücherpodcast vom RBB. Mit Anne-Dore Krohn und Nadine Kreuzhaller.
Große Prominenz diesmal in Orte und Worte. Nadine, du hast dich mit niemand anderem als T.C. Boyle getroffen. Der US-Amerikaner ist ja mit seinen Büchern wie Worlds and Wassermusik, Amerika, Grün ist die Hoffnung und zuletzt Blue Skies ganz schön berühmt. Mit seinem neuen Roman No Way Home war er gerade in Deutschland und in Österreich auf Tour, natürlich auch in Berlin. Und du hast ihn getroffen, Nadine.
Ja, genau, so war es.
Der kommt ja ziemlich regelmäßig aus Kalifornien her, da lebt er. Und man hat so den Eindruck, Deutschland gefällt ihm.
Auf jeden Fall. Also alle 2 Jahre, um genau zu sein, kommt er hierher. Immer dann, wenn ein neuer Roman von ihm erscheint. Er ist ein unglaublich fleißiger Schreiber. Fans wissen das. Jedes Jahr erscheint ein neues Buch. Wenn kein Roman, dann eben Kurzgeschichten. Der nächste Kurzgeschichtenband wird gerade schon vorbereitet und erscheint dann schon im kommenden Frühjahr auf Deutsch. Übrigens, seine Bücher, die erscheinen ja mittlerweile oft zuerst in Deutschland und erst dann in den USA, so wie im Fall von No Way Home. Wir können es schon längst lesen in der Übersetzung von Dirk van Gunsteren, aber erst im Frühjahr erscheint das englische Original zeitgleich in den USA und in Europa. Da können wir dann hier schon die Kurzgeschichten lesen, die neuen.
Ja, kein Wunder, dass T.C. Boyle hier eine unglaubliche Fanbase hat in Deutschland. Und du hast ihn ja schon mehrfach gesprochen in den letzten Jahren. Was glaubst du aber, woran liegt das, dass er hier bei uns so gut ankommt?
Das hat, glaube ich, mehrere Gründe. Also seine Fanbase, die ist wirklich enorm. Ich war bei seiner Lesung in der Philharmonie hier. Also unglaublich, wie sich die Massen im Anschluss durchs gesamte Foyer geschlängelt haben und geduldig gewartet haben. 1,5 Stunden, das hat mir T.C. Boyle dann bei unserem Gespräch erzählt, hat er Autogramme gegeben und mit den Leuten gesprochen. Also das hat schon sowas Popstar-artiges, ohne dass er Popstar-Allüren hätte. Das kommt, glaube ich, gut an. Er nimmt sich Zeit, er spricht mit den Leuten, er ist ein wahnsinnig nahbar Typ. Auch auf Social Media lässt er die Menschen an seinem Alltag teilhaben, beantwortet auch da Fragen. Ja, und zum anderen ist T.C. Boyle natürlich auch sowas wie der gute Amerikaner, der Amerikaner von nebenan, der auf der guten Seite steht. Und deshalb wird er ja auch immer gerne zu den politischen Verhältnissen in seinem Land befragt. Und auch ich habe ihn natürlich darauf angesprochen. Ich konnte nicht anders.
Das verstehe ich. Das hätte ich wahrscheinlich auch gemacht. Und ich freue mich ja immer total zu hören, wenn Literatur buchstäblich die Massen so bewegt und so viele da geduldig gewartet haben. Aber ihr habt bestimmt auch über seinen neuen Roman gesprochen. No Way Home, oder? Was ist das für ein Buch?
Na klar. No Way Home ist eine Dreiecksgeschichte in der Wüste Nevadas. 2 Männer stehen auf dieselbe Frau, also eine ziemlich klassische, fast archaische Geschichte. Der eine, Terry, absolviert in einem Krankenhaus in L.A. 14-Stunden-Schichten als Assistenzarzt. Dann stirbt seine Mutter plötzlich und er muss nach Boulder City, um die Erbschaft zu regeln. Dazu gehören ein Haus und ein Hund. Und dort in der Wüste Nevadas in Boulder City, weit weg vom Großstadtleben in Los Angeles, trifft er Bethany in einer Bar, verbringt eine Nacht mit ihr. Und ja, sie wurde gerade von ihrem Ex-Freund aus der Wohnung geschmissen. Sie sucht ein Zuhause und als Terry wieder zurück in L.A. ist, nistet sie sich einfach ungefragt und dreist in das leerstehende Haus seiner Mutter ein. Ja, zuerst ist er wütend, aber eigentlich ist er da auch schon völlig verblendet oder geblendet von ihrer Schönheit, ihrem Charme, ihrer Dreistigkeit und steckt da schon mittendrin in einer Art Beziehung. Aber es gibt einen Störfaktor. Jesse, den Ex-Freund von Bethany, ein Lehrer und Möchtegern-Schriftsteller mit Motorrad, der zu Gewaltausbrüchen neigt und immer noch eine toxische Anziehung auf sie ausübt. Ja, und hier kommen jetzt eben Eifersucht, Besitzansprüche, Kontrollwahn ins Spiel. Das Ganze eskaliert immer wieder. Es ist ein toxisches Gespann, abwechselnd aus den 3 Perspektiven erzählt. Und man fühlt sich eigentlich bei keinem der 3 so richtig zu Hause. Und das ist, der Titel sagt es ja, No Way Home, kein Weg nach Hause. Das eigentliche Thema dieses Romans, ein Gefühl des Unbehaustseins. Die Figuren pendeln zwischen hier und da, ihre Wohnungen wirken lieblos, vernachlässigt oder sie haben erst gar keine eigene. Sie sind allesamt auf der Suche nach ihrem Platz und nach Sinn. Und gleichzeitig, das macht T.C. Boyle ja auch immer ganz gut, zieht er die Blende auf und zeigt die verrohte Gesellschaft, den Zustand der Welt mit all den Abgründen, Klimawandel, Make America Great Again Bewegung, die MAGA-Bewegung, toxische Männlichkeit und ja, das alles aber ohne es direkt zu benennen. Das besticht durch so eine Atmosphäre aus Unbehagen und latenter Bedrohung.
Also viel amerikanische Gegenwart scheint in diesem neuen Roman zu stecken. Nadine, wo hast du denn T.C. Boyle eigentlich getroffen? Wo habt ihr euch verabredet?
Am Potsdamer Platz. Wir haben es uns einfach gemacht in seinem Hotel in Sichtweite zur Philharmonie. Und wir durften ins Hotelzimmer von Christina Knecht vom Hansa Verlag. Sie hat ihr Hotelzimmer für uns geräumt und sie hat ihn auf seiner Tour begleitet. Ja, und da haben wir uns dann in aller Ruhe unterhalten können. Kann man ja fast schon gar nicht mehr sagen, ne? Dass man mit einem Schriftsteller aufs Hotelzimmer geht.
Sagen. Aber vielen Dank an Christina Knecht, die großartige Pressesprecherin vom Hansa Verlag, dass sie sogar ihr Hotelzimmer für Interviews zur Verfügung stellt. Sowas brauchen wir. Und jetzt haben wir das Glück, Nadine zu hören im Gespräch mit dem Star-Schriftsteller T.C. Boyle.
Hallo.
Guten Morgen, Nadine.
Guten Morgen. Nice to meet you.
Likewise, my dear.
How are you doing?
Well, it's always fun to do these tours, but exhausting to be away from home for 3 weeks, but it's very rewarding. I've done this many times. I have good friends in almost every city that we go to. So it's fun. Plus, I brought my daughter with me. It's the first time she has been away from her children in her life. She has two little boys. One is 6 and one is 4. However, she lives right next door to me in Santa Barbara. So Oma is there to sit on those little babies.
Nice. I think it's more comfortable to have someone with you and on a tour like this. It can be more fun.
It's fun for her. She's very devoted to her children. She doesn't work. She just is a mother. Yeah. But she doesn't get a lot of sleep with the two little kids. They're up at 5 every morning.
Yeah, of course.
So I've noticed on this tour when it's time for das Frühstück, I have to wake her up.
I'm trying to sleep a little longer to get adjusted to German time. So I'm sleeping until around 8. I go out and take a walk around the neighborhood, have das Frühstück, and then prepare for whatever the day may bring. We've had a lot of public shows, and we've done a lot of interviews as well.
And have you seen Potsdamer Platz? Because this is a kind of special place here in Berlin, or very important place in terms of history for Berlin, this Potsdamer Platz. I mean, how do you experience this area?
I have been here many times, and I do enjoy it. I like some of the older cities better, a smaller scale. I do enjoy Potsdamer Platz, and I've been able to tour Berlin many times, and so I got to see quite a bit of the city every time I come. And of course, I have many close friends here. I'll be going out to a friend's apartment tonight for dinner, so it really feels at home, and it feels great. After all these many, many years, I do not speak German. Though I, like a trained dog, I have a few phrases, but I come for, 3 weeks every 2 years and then go home and forget all about it. So I have to apologize for that. But my life is in California.
Speaking of feeling at home, we are sitting in the middle of this very cozy but neutral hotel room. What do you need to feel at home?
I need love. And the most amazing thing about the audiences, these huge audiences that are turning out for these talks that I'm giving, is the tremendous affection I'm getting from the readers here. I don't know if I've earned it exactly, but I am accepting it and loving it.
But you personally, what do you need? I mean, if you're traveling now, you're far away from home. So what do you need to feel like? Do you bring something with you when you are traveling?
No, I mean, I travel with the minimal amount of crap to haul around. I detest the airlines. And we've had to fly twice during this tour because it's been great distances. You know, we came first to Vienna. I love the Deutsche Bahn, even though I made some jokes about them last time I was here. I love travel by train. I'm having a great time, a truly great time.
No Way Home, your novel is called. So we've spoken about feeling at home. The novel, I think, is about not feeling at home at all. So the protagonists are, I mean, whether they don't have a home like Bethany, mm-hmm. or they lose home, or they are traveling between Los Angeles and Boulder City. So they are in between something, so seeking for a home maybe. And there is Jesse, who maybe don't need a home. So out of which feeling did you write this novel?
Well, I love your analysis of the characters in that question. That was great. I'm wondering what is a home and where do you feel comfortable and where do you feel protected? With Terrence, who opens the novel, he is a young MD who's just gotten his degree and he's working as an intern in Los Angeles in the big public hospital there, treating everybody who walks through the door or is hauled through the door, that is, the homeless especially. The novel begins with he's doing his rounds. He's working 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, as many interns do. It's kind of slave labor. His phone rings, and the neighbor of his mother in Boulder City reports that she has died. He doesn't have any connection with Boulder City. His mother moved there because she liked the desert and liked being out in the country. After his father died 5 years previously, he'd grown up in Los Angeles. So when he does go to his mother's house, where she has just died the day before, he sees some of the things that she's brought with her, pieces of furniture, for instance, that look familiar to him. But the house is rather alien. And also another key player in this is the dog, Daisy. Just a big black dog of indeterminate breed that his mother has had as a companion since her husband died 5 years earlier.
Yeah, so he's not loving Daisy at first sight, Terrence. So he's trying to adapt to all this. Yeah, there's this house and the life of his mother. He wasn't really part of her life anymore because he was in LA and trapped in these 14-hour days. So what is happening with him there when he enters the house and when he gets in contact suddenly with the life of his mother?
I think it's difficult when someone close to you has died, and sometimes a simple object can bring that back to you. Now, had she died in his boyhood home, it would be different. He would feel at home there. But this space in Boulder City is alien to him. And I should say to the listeners that Boulder City is a small town 26 miles east of Las Vegas, where the Hoover Dam is. A remarkable thing, built in 1935 to dam up the Colorado River and provide us in Southern California with water. The politics are very different. It's a big city versus small town. We don't know Bethany's politics exactly, but they're far more to the right than our Terrence's. And, you know, some readers have seen in this a kind of parable about America today. And, you know, I think that is there. After all, I wrote the book in the run-up to the most catastrophic election in our history. And this is not specifically about that. It's more about the environment of the area, the water that we need, and how the dam went up and all of that. But it's certainly there under the surface.
Yeah, I would. I totally agree. It's all there, I would say. It's the atmosphere is very tense. A lot of things that are happening now in the U.S., I guess, are there under the surface, like the homeless people in L.A. or, yeah, the differences between the urban parts of America and the parts on the countryside. Would you say the Boulder area is MAGA land?
Yes, to a degree. It is a little a tourist city that exists because of the dam and tourists coming to see the dam. And the lake. The lake has provided a tremendous arena for boating and water skiing and swimming and so on. Yes, I wouldn't want to make too much of it, but there is a divide in America between the urban areas and the rural areas, and the urban states and the rural states, as you see in the news. Again, I didn't want to address the question directly because I had other ideas in mind, and that is the idea, of, as you stated, of what is your home. But it is certainly present. As far as addressing what's happening in America today, I waited until I'd finished the novel, at which point I wrote 6 new short stories to go with the 6 I'd written before the novel for my next book, which Hanse will publish in the spring. And there is one story in it, a satire of what's happening currently in the current administration in the U.S. So you'll have to wait till next year for that.
Yeah, but I think even reading your novel, No Way Home, you can get this feeling. I mean, you are not addressing it directly, but you can get this feeling. It's like creeping in this really...
Paranoia?
Yeah, maybe paranoia. Mm. It's like there. For example, I think it's a very strong picture. This picture of all these things coming from the underground to the surface, things in the lake, because of the lake is losing water. Yes. So you are now seeing whatever, like skeletons and really creepy things. So it's a strong picture maybe for what is going on in America.
I think you're absolutely right, Nadine, and I love your interpretation of it. Yes, for those who haven't yet read the book, Lake Mead is this enormous lake in the desert of the huge Colorado River dammed up. And it was finished in 1935, and it took 3 full years for it to fill till 1938. Now, however, in the Southwest, because of global warming, which the administration denies and is complicating by overturning all the green initiatives of the previous administration, the lake is receding. You can see in the book what's called the bathtub ring around the lake. That is, you can see the mineral deposits that the water laid down around the shoreline. And it's quite considerable and alarming. Also, as Terence points out, again, he's sort of a fish out of water. He doesn't know this place very well. It's an amazing thing to have this huge blue lake in the middle of a desert. There are only less than 5 inches of rain a year. This is true desert. And yet, here you have this lake. I had intended originally to write more about the origin of the lake, because it, like Blue Skies and Ein Freund der Erde, which preceded it, there is always an environmental aspect to everything I'm writing. As the story turned out, though, you do get that sense. Jesse, the bad guy, I guess he's a bad guy. People who don't like dogs are always bad, aren't they? He has ambition. He's a sort of wild youth, 25. He rides a bike that can go off-road as well as on the road. But he is educated. He has a degree. He is a 6th-grade teacher of language arts, but he has higher ambitions. He wants to be a fiction writer for the glories that come with it, you know, the fans and the money and so on, only for this. And it's a gentle satire, I think. Do you really think he's going to have the ability to do it? So there, again, I don't like to portray things in a black and white way, in the way of the movies. There's a good guy, there's a bad guy. Jesse isn't entirely a bad guy, although he does some very reprehensible things in this novel.
What strikes me as well is that they are having this triangle of love, but they are not really connecting. No one of them is really connecting to each other. There's a distance and there's some ego trips going on.
Just like in the real world. Yeah, we fall in love, but there is always an element of calculation. It's not blind. And Bethany has broken up with her boyfriend. He's a very handsome and very dynamic guy. And yet they had their differences, and she picks up Terrence on the morning he's come to town to deal with his dead mother and her alien house and her dog and everything else. He's in a vulnerable moment. But also, because he has invested so much of his time into his medical training, he's a little bit of a nerd. He doesn't have a lot of experience with women or in the wider world. And she takes advantage of that. She's extremely attractive, and she's very bright. They're young. Both Bethany and Jesse are only 25. When I was 25, I was completely unmoored from any kind of reason and out of my mind at all times. They're growing up. They're finding out what they can do when they grow up. When I was 25, I didn't need to be running around trying to kill myself every night with a bunch of idiots and doing drugs and so on. I found what I could do in life, writing, and I went to graduate school. And from then on, I have pursued it without turning away. But before that, as a young man, I was pretty deranged in a lot of ways, and I'm channeling that a bit. Frau Boyle gave me stability in those years. We were together. We hadn't yet gotten married, but we were together. And I really needed that, because young men and women too, in the search for meaning, and that has to do with love or at least mating, we tend to do extreme and hurtful things. As far as I can tell, in the absence of God or any reason for the life of our species, the only purpose of life is to create more life, period. That's it. But when you're, no one wants to admit this, even in old age, whether you've created life or not, that is what it's all about. And so there is this mating ritual that we all go through.
You spoke about the circumstances, writing this novel, like that the most catastrophic elections took place while you were writing this novel. So how did it affect the writing?
Well, you've seen it, and in your early questions, you addressed it. There's a tension. There still is this terrible tension in our society. And I was trying to address it, but not directly, because I was already writing this novel about something else altogether. I think the readers so far have seen that in the novel, and I think it gives it an extra depth beyond just this love triangle with two guys fighting over one girl, like the Rams battering heads together. And then, of course, there is that. That's what drives the whole book.
It's a picture of this backlash kind of manhood, isn't it? Two men fighting for one woman is very archaic. Yeah, and I think in the US since Trump, there's a lot of old-fashioned men.
Yes, manhood.
Energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with the current regime, there is all of this propaganda and the denigration of women and minorities and so on. I think that tension is present in the novel, although the novel doesn't directly address it. And so, you know, we're an animal species, and we do fight for the right to mate. And whether this is overt fighting, as in this case between these two men, or it's more subtle, nonetheless, anytime we hook up in a relationship, there is the attraction, the animal attraction, that's first and primary, But then if you settle into a relationship, then you begin to feel comfortable and love a person for the other qualities beyond just the sexual. The novel, to me, ends perfectly and hauntingly. But I'm not telling you what happens to them in the future. I leave that to the reader. I leave the ending at a moment when the reader can be drawn back into the story and imagine for him or herself, where's it going? What does it mean? What happens after the last line of the story? And I think I was very happy to discover the last line of this one. I should say, too, that to write a novel is a kind of tightrope walking. I never know what it will be or where it will go. All my structure is internal, and I discover it day by day as I progress through the novel. And if I'm lucky, it comes to fruition in a way that is tremendously exhilarating. Some of your listeners may know my essay, This Monkey, Comma, My Back, which I wrote some years ago, likening the creative process to a kind of drug high. You feel this tremendous rush of joy and beauty when you finish something and you see that it's right. But because you're addicted, it wears off pretty quickly, and then you have to do it again and again and again. I've just written my 33rd book, which will come out next year from Hansa Verlag, the short story collection. The end is only a beginning. And I've begun just tentatively the first chapter of the next novel. Once Hansa Verlag lets me go home again, I hope to be writing that. That is my addiction. It's my art. I love to do what I do because the world is so confusing and antithetical to us and utterly without meaning of any kind. And so I like, through my art, to address these questions and try to find meaning for myself, and also to try to understand how I feel about what's happening in the world. And of course, as you know, I write many things about science and biology, which are my main obsessions, biology especially. And often I am able to address that in the short stories, whereas I don't know about other writers, but I can only do one thing at a time. I'm afraid if I did try to write two things at once, I would weaken one or the other. So when I'm writing a novel, as with this one, as we said, during this time of political ferment and absolute fear on my part, I had to keep a lid on that while I wrote this particular novel, waiting for the short stories. And as I said earlier, I have one satire in this one about the current American political scene. But again, with stories, I get to address anything that concerns me.
In the Philharmonie here in Berlin, you've told the audience about a little bit about your next novel, that there would be a librarian at the center of it, and that you want to deal with book bans. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Well, we never know what it will be, but I've just started, and I have a lot of research to do with librarians in libraries. I am very upset by many things happening in American society, one of which is the censorship. The right wing is censoring what we can read and what can be in our libraries. And so I've decided to try to explore that topic a bit. And I have just begun writing. There'll be the interruption of these 3 weeks here in Germany. When I get back, I hope I will be able to settle into it again. I do need to do much more research, but I wanted to get some prose, some beauty down on paper before I had to come here.
Why is this topic, this book bans, one of the most bothering, maybe? You've spoken of fear a few minutes ago. So what is bothering you, yeah, relating to the book bans or what is happening now?
We used to live in a democracy, as you do currently, and the government and the right-wing protesters and so on really have upended our freedoms, our freedom to choose what we would like to say or do or read. And I think that is right at the essence of these changes we're seeing. I don't want to be exclusively negative, though. I have great hope since this recent election earlier this month, throughout the country, the agenda that the current administration is promoting was soundly defeated everywhere. The big election, of course, is next year, next November, the midterms. Can we change the composition of the House of Representatives so that there will be a break on the unlimited power the current administration is wielding? So I do have hope. A lot will happen between now and then, and we shall see.
You seem to be optimistic again.
I am one of the most pessimistic people ever born, but in this case, I do see that there is a possible light shining. You know, we are coming up on the 250th anniversary of the founding of America, and it is quite shameful that it will be celebrated under a regime like the current one. But still, I think there is in the American spirit a real desire for democracy and equal rights, all the things that the Constitution guarantees us, but which are in doubt at the very moment, this very moment.
Is America still a democracy right at this moment?
Theoretically, judicially, yes. But in fact, the president is ruling by fiat because there is no one to oppose him. The Supreme Court and both houses of Congress are in Republican hands. And these people don't seem to give a damn about democracy. They only care about their own power. So, I do believe that our democracy is deeply entrenched and that we will be able to overcome this. And I do believe most Americans, even those who are far to the right from me, are shocked and fed up with the antics of the current administration. And I do believe we will see change.
Okay, do you really think so? I mean, sometimes it can be very frightening to watch from outside what is going on. I mean, we also have to fear it here as well, because in Germany there's this right-wing party, and in all of Europe things are shifting to the right. And in the US, I mean, all this hunting immigrants down and all these things are very horrible, and sometimes I feel like being in a bad apocalypse movie.
How
do you feel?
I feel exactly the same way, of course. Again, we have a long history of democracy, and this is the biggest threat we've ever had to it, and I do believe we will overcome it. But between now and this next election, so much can happen. The administration is already trying to subvert the election, knowing that it is unpopular and will lose a fair election. So we're all very nervous. Everything is tentative in terms of the stock market and building new houses and everything else. Everyone is waiting to see what is going to happen, and we're all expecting the worst to happen. I'm expecting the best to happen. I am expecting that things will turn, and this is just a dark period in our history.
There was just this banned book week in America. It's taking part every year since 1982. So it's not a new phenomenon that books are banned from libraries and from schools. But since Trump, there is a peak of book bans. So why is it so important, or how do you try to protest against these book bans?
It is a fact that so many books have been, many more than ever before. That doesn't necessarily mean that they are removed from the library shelves. there's a whole process. If a citizen doesn't like a particular book, they can protest, and then a committee will decide whether or not that should go forward while the book remains on the shelf and is accessible and available to everyone, which is a very good thing. Just the fact that we have to discuss it is obscene. A lot of what's happening is there are right-wing groups who have a list of books, of titles they don't like, and often the titles have to do with bisexuality and sexual issues and racial issues and so on. And often the people protesting have not read the books, and in some cases the libraries don't even have the books that they're protesting against. It's a kind of uniform denunciation of the freedom to read and think.
One of your books is on a list of banned books in some states, Tortilla Curtain. Mm-hmm. Why?
I find it sadly amusing. And one list I found online of banned books, you know, there are things like The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, brilliantly predicting our future now. And you know, much more wide-read than the Tortilla Curtain. But the Tortilla Curtain is very predictive of where we are in terms of ethnic division and immigrants from Mexico. It was very prophetic, I guess, sadly so, because the problem is twice as bad as it had been when I wrote the book way back in 1995. And so in this one list I found online of books banned, this book was banned in some library in the South somewhere, and the only reason was a single word: provocative. That's why it has to be banned. But isn't art supposed to be provocative? What is it supposed to be? A soporific to put you to sleep? It amazes me how Orwellian the world is, how everything is turned on its head.
In what terms are you discussing all these with friends? I mean, the American society is really divided at this moment. Do you notice this in your personal environment?
Well, this is the problem of the division. No matter what I write or what I say in an interview, the only people who will find it or hear it already agree with me. All my audience and my Twitter audience and so on, well, they why are they there? Well, because they agree with me. So I'm not certainly not changing any minds on the other side. I am a little bit unique, though, in that I come from the working class and a democratic nation that felt that a country should support all its citizens of every stripe and educate them for the betterment of society has made me what I am. I went to public high school in New York, and to public university in New York, and to a public university in Iowa for my Master of Fine Arts in the Writer's Workshop and my PhD as well. So I have come out of the working class because the society enabled me to do so. It doesn't seem to be operating anymore. But because I came from the working class, I have no problem with having working class friends. In California, where I'm living now, almost everyone I meet, would agree with my politics. However, I've spent a lot of time in a rural area in the Sierra Nevada mountains. I have very close friends, and we've gone on together for many, many years. And in such a small community where you're isolated, you become even more intensely acquainted with people because there's nothing to do aside from walk in the woods. You go to each other's house and you cook dinner for each other and so on. And I have many, many close friends. We've always respected each other in terms of politics. I don't try to change their minds. It's impossible. And they don't. We try not to discuss politics. Sadly, though, I haven't gone there recently because I couldn't imagine, and no matter how much I like these people otherwise, hearing the present administration praised. So that has kept me away from them or talking to people whose viewpoint politically is opposed to mine. It's no longer a friendly thing. It's more a kind of opposition.
At the end, I would like to ask you one more question. It's about books, literature. What are you reading at the moment? And would you like to recommend some book?
I realized that I'm part of a trend. I just read the New Yorker, which is featuring an article about the 250th anniversary, and the lead up to it on the public broadcasting system is Ken Burns' documentary about the Revolutionary War. And some of it is based on Rick Atkinson's trilogy about the Revolutionary War, which I am now reading for the second time. It's very inspiring and beautiful. I never quite realized how close we were to being crushed by the British Empire and King George III. And I love reading about it, not only because of the times we're in, but also because some of the major battles took place right there in New York, where I grew up. And our teachers would tell us about this, but really, they didn't let us know that it happened right outside the window of the classroom. One of the reasons that I wrote World's End, a history of the a novel that has a history of the Hudson Valley where I grew up, is so I could become more acquainted with this. And now Atkinson gives us wonderful details that most history books or classes that we would take didn't give us.
Thank you very much.
Bitte schön.
DC Boyle im Gespräch mit Nadine über seinen neuen Roman No Way Home. Und seine Buchempfehlung findet ihr wie immer in unseren Shownotes und auf den Webseiten von Radio 3 und RBB 24 Inforadio. Nadine, jetzt mal Hand auf Herz. Hand aufs Herz. Hast du dir eigentlich von DC Boyle auch ein Autogramm geben lassen oder mehrere?
Ja, na klar. Also da konnte ich natürlich nicht widerstehen. Und ich habe auch gleich noch eins für eine Freundin mitgenommen, die großer DC Boyle-Fan ist, sozusagen als Weihnachtsgeschenk. Und ein Foto haben wir natürlich auch noch zusammen gemacht. Dafür sind wir dann noch rüber in sein Zimmer, weil er da so einen schönen Balkon hatte.
Aha, auf dem Balkon mit DC Boyle, da seid ihr also auch gelandet. Aber da wir ja eh jetzt gerade in Riesenschritten auf Weihnachten zulaufen, für wen wäre denn No Way Home von DC Boyle ein gutes Geschenk?
Also für alle, die Spaß haben an plotgetriebenen Geschichten, die man so durchsuchten kann. Es ist nicht der beste DC Boyle, muss ich sagen, gerade was die Figurenzeichnung angeht. Aber was ich an No Way Home wirklich mag, ist, wie er hier mit starken Bildern im Hintergrund der Geschichte eine bedrohliche Atmosphäre aufbaut. So ein Gefühl von Paranoia und Spaltung, das ja für das Gefühl steht, das wir alle, glaube ich, gerade haben oder teilweise bekommen, mit Blick auf die politische Situation in Europa, aber natürlich auch in den USA. Auch wenn es vordergründig um eine Liebes- und Dreiecksgeschichte geht. Man merkt DC Boyle allerdings im Gespräch ja ein wenig an, dass er auch etwas müde ist, immer wieder über Politik sprechen zu müssen. Das ist natürlich sehr verständlich. Und es wirkt auch so, als müsse er sich und anderen immer wieder Mut zusprechen. Er hat übrigens am 2. Dezember seinen 77. Geburtstag gefeiert, auf Tour zwischen zwei Lesungen und sitzt jetzt gerade, wenn alles nach seinem Plan gelaufen ist, wieder am Schreibtisch und schreibt an seinem nächsten Roman. Und darin geht es ja dann, er hat es verraten, um Bibliotheken und Bücherverbote in den USA. Und deshalb möchte ich hier auch noch meine Buchempfehlung abgeben. Middlesex von Jeffrey Eugenides steht auf einer dieser verbotenen Bücherliste in den USA, 2003 mit dem Pulitzerpreis ausgezeichnet. Und ich würde empfehlen, diesen großartigen Roman nochmal zu lesen, der auf verschlungenen Wegen zwischen einem griechischen Bergdorf, den Vereinigten Staaten und Berlin von Intersexualität erzählt. Gibt es als Taschenbuch, ist also auch ein tolles Geschenk für alle, ja, die weit ausholende, epische, sprachlich ausgefeilte Geschichten mögen. Oder eben No Way Home, auch ein Roman, der auf jeden Fall etwas für DC Boyle-Fans ist.
Ja, Eugenides ist auf jeden Fall auch eins meiner Lieblingsbücher aus den letzten Jahrzehnten, muss ich wirklich sagen. Kann ich dir nur zustimmen. Und wer weiß, für wen No Way Home von T.C. Boyle vielleicht auch ein neues Lieblingsbuch werden wird. Erschienen ist der Roman im Hansa Verlag, hat 382 Seiten, wurde übersetzt von Dirk van Gunsteren und kostet 28 Euro.
Und alle Buchempfehlungen übrigens findet ihr in den Shownotes und natürlich auf den Webseiten von Radio 3 und RBB 24 Inforadio.
Das war Orte und Worte für heute. Wir sagen Tschüss. Ich bin Anne-Dore Krohn.
Ich bin Nadine Kreuzzahler. Viel Spaß beim Lesen und Hören.
Tschüss.
Tschüss.
Orte und Worte. Der Bücherpodcast vom RBB. Redaktion Nadine Kreuzzahler. Technik Jana Graziano. Sounddesign Robin Rudolph. Eine Produktion von Radio 3 und RBB 24 Inforadio.